Carolina, and has long been one of the nation's best-known recovery speakers. A certified addictions counselor in North Carolina, he teaches at alcohol and drug counseling workshops, conferences, schools, and institutes throughout the United States and Canada. He's the author of Sobriety is a Learning Process, a best-selling curriculum for recovery from alcoholism, and Thirsting for Wholeness, describing the spiritual journey of addiction and recovery, both published by Health Communications. Please join me in giving Tom Brady a warm Little Rock welcome.
Thank you, Kenny. I don't know if this microphone's on, is it? Can everybody hear? I can hear me coming through this thing. I lost my name card, and so I forgot who I was. But I'm really practicing anonymity, I guess. My name's Tom Brady, and I'm an alcoholic. Some of you out there no doubt know me by another name, Puddinhead. And some of them called me that this afternoon, and I said, look, I'm here as a professional tonight. You can't call me Puddinhead, because that's not a professional name. I want to thank Karen and Charlie and all the others for having me back out here. This is one of my favorite places to be. I don't know why they keep asking me back, but I'm glad they do, and I'll come again next year if you want me to. She said it all depends on how I do tonight. And like I said, I've never done this particular one before, and it has a special personal meaning for me, as I'll get into as I go. I guess I'm what is known as a dinosaur in the field of addictions. There are many people out there looking for new ways to recover and to deal with the problems of sobriety. I'm not, because I'm satisfied that we already have a way. It is the way which has worked so consistently, so well, for so long, for so many. As a matter of fact, it's worked so well in my life that if I can manage to stay sober until a month from tonight, I'll have 29 years of sobriety. That does not mean, by the way, that I'm special or that I'm a 12-step bigot, because I certainly am not. But this program has worked very, very well in my life, and I tend to circle in and around it and try to look at it in new ways. As a new problem occurs, I try to look at the principles by which I've tried to live and pick out which principles might be able to solve the problem that I'm having right now. And it's never failed to work. I'm kind of like the old mountain man from North Carolina who went down to a flea market one Saturday and bought himself an old bill fiddle. And it didn't have but one string on it. And he took it home and he'd stand on the front porch and he'd stand there just plunking on that one string. He was about to drive his wife crazy all day long, just plunk, plunk, plunk from dawn till dark. And she went down to the store one day to go grocery shopping, and she came back and she said, you're not playing that thing right. She said, I saw a man downtown and he had a bull fiddle. It had four strings on him and he was moving his hand up and down and playing different notes, and you're just not doing it right. And the old boy's still just plunking that one string. He said, well, I guess that fellow's looking for something. I found what I want. I am not a spiritual giant, and I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm kind of leery of people who are looked upon as spiritual giants. You know, some people get too spiritual. I went through a phase of that in my recovery, along about 2 years, where we go through that period called the terrible twos, where we know everything there is to know, and we wonder why anybody asks anybody else anything. And I'm glad I'm out of that. It's nice to say I don't know every now and again, but I heard a story about a guy that was getting so spiritual, all he could talk about was God, 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 all the time, 24 hours a day. And his wife was sick of hearing it. But he woke up one morning and he said, I'm so close to God, when I went to the bathroom last night, God turned the light on for me. And he said, when I left, God turned the light off. And she said, you old fool, you peed in the refrigerator again. So much for spiritual matters, huh? I have a real problem and an extreme dislike that I want to share with you, and it's for the term substance abuser. And I'm not being facetious when I say this, I'm being serious. To me, this term is inaccurate, misleading, and degrading to addicts and alcoholics. You know, if you don't call those whose bodies react abnormally to sugar, sugar abusers, and those whose bodies react abnormally to penicillin, penicillin abusers, and those whose bodies react abnormally to, pollen abusers, then why do you call those whose bodies react abnormally to alcohol, alcohol abusers? Good question. Is there still a stigma? You bet there is. And it's alive and it's well. And the strangest thing about it is that it's being perpetuated by some of the people in the field of addictions. The term alcohol abuser is inaccurate and degrading because it clearly indicts the alcoholic, and vindicates alcohol. It says the person is totally to blame and the drug is totally innocent. The alcoholic is the villain and the alcohol is the victim. Now to me, this is not surprising since alcohol is the sacred drug of our society. And it seems like we'll go to any lengths to protect it. What is surprising to me is that the field of addictions, which should be working to eliminate the stigma, and as a matter of fact is still perpetuating the stigma by using this erroneous terminology. I think we need to give some serious attention to this. I think it's not only absurd, I think it's wrong. I really do. I've never met an alcoholic who harmed alcohol, but I have known many alcoholics who were harmed and even killed by alcohol. And I submit that for your thought. I think we need to do some thinking. I know that we don't intentionally perpetuate this stigma, but by using this terminology, are we doing it? To make the point more clear, let's take a look at those who call people like me alcohol abusers. So-called social drinkers. Social drinkers made me sick when I was drinking, and they make me sick now. They go to these things called cocktail parties. Now, I like to study words. Have you ever spent some time studying that word, cocktail? That is a very interesting word. It'll tickle you if you think about it long enough, you know. And a cocktail party is where you go to chit-chat. You know, that means you talk at me, and I don't care what you're saying, and I talk at you, and you don't care what I'm saying. We're just putting in our time at this cocktail party. And then they bring out some very fine liquor, and they start putting mess in it. They put Pepsi-Cola and Sprite, water, orange juice, club soda, milk, man. And that's not enough. Then they put vegetables in it, you know, a little celery, some carrots and onions and olives and things. That's not enough either. Then they start putting the fruit in, you know, oranges and apples and tangerines and cherries. Then they squirt whipped cream on top of it and stick an umbrella in it with a straw through the middle, you know. Now, when you take perfectly good liquor and put all that mess in it, that to me is alcohol abuse. And then when they got it all messed up, they don't know what to do with it. They suck it. Alcohol is not meant to be sucked. It's meant to be gulped. I knew that when I first started drinking, you know. And then the glass gets halfway down, and they think it's half full. I'm an alcoholic. The glass halfway down, it's half empty. And the host approaches. The host is what they call a pusher at this cocktail party. And he says, "May I freshen your drink?" And I think to myself, what does that mean? More whipped cream? And they draw the glass back and say, "Oh, no, I'm beginning to feel it." And I want to hit them. If you don't want to feel it, why are you drinking it? People drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I read that somewhere. Alcohol has one purpose, make you feel good. You know, you don't want to feel good. You take all them onions and olives and all that other stuff, give me the alcohol. Because you're abusing it. I know what it's for. I will use it. Okay? And in all seriousness, I think we need to give some close attention to what it is that we're saying and the picture it is that we're portraying and what we're doing to perpetuate the shame and the guilt that's already connected with addiction. And I'm serious about that. Let's get down to it now. I don't know what I'm going to talk about tonight. I mean, I got a bunch of papers up here, and it may go 30 minutes, and it may go, you know, an hour and a half, maybe even 2 hours. But I remember what my sponsor told me. He says, "You never have to be alone again unless you talk over an hour." So y'all can feel pretty safe here, you know. I look around me, and what I see is a we world. It's a world of relationships, of interdependency. It has been said that each of us is the only one who can give the other what each of us needs to have. All of us like to receive support, approval, and love from other people. Indeed, we need these things, I do, to reinforce what we feel and believe about ourselves. When we accept input from others properly, it gives support to what we know, feel, and believe about ourselves, and I believe we're healthy. However, when we become too dependent on what others say about us, our beliefs and feelings about ourselves can become based on their input only. And when this happens, we are not healthy. I believe, and some of you know, that life is like a journey. I didn't come up with that. Other people came up with it, and I believe it. The last few years of my journey have been a very trying time. And at a certain point of time, exactly the right time as it turns out, I came upon an article that was in the AA Grapevine in the year of 1958 in January, written by one of the co-founders, Bill W., and the title of it was The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety. And upon reading this, I found out what it was precisely and exactly that I was going through at this time. In this article, which is a letter to another old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill addresses the issue of over-dependence on other people. Using his own self as an example, he tells why, even though he was practicing the principles of the program in his life, he was not experiencing the joy and the peace he felt he should feel from doing so. Although he was living the life, he still felt insecure, insignificant, and virtually worthless. He knew he was doing what was right and good, yet he did not feel good about himself. And he knew that depression was just around the corner. And for those of you who do not know about Bill W., he was a world-class depressive. There was a period in his sobriety from 1944 until 1955 when there were days when he was completely unable to get out of bed because of depression. And obviously, he didn't want to be put down by depression again, so he started looking at himself very closely. And through examining his life, he discovered that he was and had been almost totally dependent on other people or groups to make him feel good about himself. Almost totally dependent, to give him approval and security and prestige. And what's more, he found that he was demanding of others that they give him these things by trying to control and possess them. In short, Bill discovered after 23 plus years of sobriety that he was emotionally unsober. He had become dependent on others to provide him with the feelings which should have come to him from himself as a result of his own actions. And it was his article, plus my own experience of being emotionally unsober, which set me to thinking about what I'm going to share with you tonight. Keep in mind, please, while I talk to you, that I'm a layman, not a psychiatrist, not in any sense an expert on anything. Therefore, I'm going to talk to you in layman's terms and in layman's language. There are two terms I'm going to use tonight. Let me explain them briefly. One is emotional sobriety. And the other is emotional inebriety, or unsoberness. Emotional sobriety, loosely defined, is when what I know about myself and what I believe and feel about myself are pretty much consistent. That is, my beliefs and feelings about me match the facts about me. When I'm emotionally sober, I know I'm a good person, and I believe it and feel good about myself, for example. And when I'm emotionally sober, the input of others affects but does not determine what I believe and how I feel about myself. Emotional inebriety or unsoberness, on the other hand, is when what I know about me and what I believe and feel about me are not consistent in any way. Sometimes they're almost totally inconsistent. That is, my beliefs and feelings about me do not match the facts about me. When I'm emotionally unsober, even though I know I'm a good person, I don't believe I am, nor do I feel good about myself. Have any of you experienced this? And when I'm emotionally unsober, the input of others almost totally determines what I believe and how I feel about myself. I'm in their hands. I look to others to give me good feelings, self-esteem, and so on. You ever ask your question if you're emotionally sober or emotionally unsober? Let me ask you a series of questions, because you don't have to be in recovery to be emotionally unsober or sober. Let me ask these questions and see what you come up with in your own mind. Do you often do a good job and know it, yet do not feel that you did, nor feel good about yourself? Do you often feel like a loser, even though you know you're not? Does what others say about you unduly influence your feelings and beliefs about yourself? When you express love for someone, are you let down when he or she doesn't respond in kind? Do you often feel afraid even though you know all is well? Do you often feel you're not enough? Do you often believe you and others are falling short of what you or they should be or do? Do you often do nice things for others in order to get attention or compliments? Does it bother you a lot when you know that someone dislikes or disapproves of you? Do you often refrain from doing or saying what you know you should do or say for fear of the reaction? I don't know how many of these questions you answered in the affirmative, but if you answered just several of them in the affirmative, you're probably emotionally unsober to some degree. Although emotional inebriety is not confined to those in recovery, it's especially important to them because it is a stage in recovery through which those in recovery will invariably pass. Let me say that again. Emotional inebriety is a stage in recovery through which those in recovery will invariably pass. And it can be very dangerous to them. At the least, it can preclude a happy, serene, and meaningful sobriety. At the worst, it can and often does lead to relapse. Two things make it more dangerous than any other thing. First, the person is usually not aware of what it is, nor of its presence in his life. And second, when he becomes aware of it and knows what it is, he can't seem to change it. He simply does not know how. Let's look at these two dangers one at a time. Why is the person not aware when he's emotionally unsober? First, most people in recovery don't even know there is such a thing. They experience the feelings, but they have no name for what is happening. They're in the dark. They just know that all is not well. Second, because it usually represents a lifelong pattern of behavior which has become a part of the person's character. And as such, it operates automatically and unconsciously. It's like a tape. A certain thing happens, a certain response comes. A certain thing happens, a certain response comes. Another thing happens, a certain response comes. That response is characteristic of me. I do it automatically and unconsciously. And I used to do things like when you would say, "Tom, you did a good job," I'd give you five reasons why I should have done better. That was my response. And I wasn't even aware that I was responding that way until it was pointed out to me. It becomes second nature to us, and therefore it's hard to spot. Third, when it shows up, it does not give a clear picture of itself. It usually shows up as a group of symptoms which can indicate a number of things. Some of these symptoms are a lingering feeling that all is not well, a sense of uneasiness, feeling down, a dull, continuous sense of anxiety, a feeling of worthlessness. Because these symptoms could indicate several conditions, emotional inebriety is often misdiagnosed, usually as depression. Over my period of time in sobriety, it is amazing to me how many of my friends in recovery have been diagnosed as being clinically depressed when, as a matter of fact, what they're suffering from is probably emotional unsoberness. What makes the condition so problematic is that it usually doesn't show up until the person is well into recovery. And when it does show up, it does so as the vague group of symptoms I just mentioned. Usually the person is doing his best to practice the program of recovery, so he simply cannot understand why, since he is doing his best, he feels so bad. Over in North Carolina, we got a term for the onset of this condition. We call it five-year menopause. Because it usually occurs somewhere between 4 and 6 years. The person is doing very well, thank you. His life is going well. His job is fine. His wife is fine. His kids are fine. He is fine. Everything's fine. And he's dragging his behind all over the place, and he doesn't know why. It's incredible how many people I have talked to come to me in this state of being. You know, I don't know what's wrong. What's wrong with me? Everything's okay. I know it's okay. Why do I feel the way that I feel? And this is when it begins to insinuate itself into the person's life, and he does not know. And unless he comes upon someone who does know, he's still in the dark. I was first confronted by five-year menopause when I was just sober for a little while, and I saw a couple of guys in my group, one about 2 weeks apart, pick up five-year tokens for 5 years of sobriety and almost get drunk immediately. That boggled my mind, and it frightened me. And I asked my sponsor, "What is happening here?" And he said, "Five-year menopause." And I said, "Well, what are you talking about?" He said, "Go and talk to the last man." And he was in the hospital, and he's in terrible condition.
And I went and I talked to him, and he told me about what I told you. Tom, I had no reason to drink, you know. Everything was just going fine. But I got so depressed, I got so down, I felt so worthless. And I said to myself, what's the use? And before you know it, I took the drink. This is a serious, serious situation. And like I say, it begins at 5 years. But what makes it even more problematic is that it usually is not clearly identified, if indeed it's identified at all, until the person is quite advanced in recovery. Notice when Bill wrote this letter that appeared in the grapevine, he was 23 plus years into recovery. When I first became aware from reading this article about what was going on with me, I was 26 years plus in recovery. Think about it. Before becoming fully aware. Oh, I was aware. You know, I was aware for a long time. And yet, the unconscious automatic responses continued. I was at this school, for instance, and I got back my evaluations. And all of the evaluations were good. Almost all of them. There was one or two that weren't. Guess which ones I noticed? Somebody will come up to me tonight and say, you made a good talk, Tom, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll say, you really think so, or something like that. That's how deep set it really is in us. And I have to watch myself constantly so as not to respond in that old manner, but to choose, if you will, a new response. And that's part of the key to getting over this thing. So is the nature of emotional inebriety that even though the person is doing well and knows it, something deep inside him refuses to let him experience the appropriate positive feelings he should have about himself. Nor is he able to believe he's a worthwhile person and that all is well. His feelings and beliefs, as I said before, are not consistent with what he knows to be true about himself and his life. He is frightened, insecure, does not like himself or his life. What does he usually do? All too often, he relapses. If he doesn't relapse, he will always seek from another person or from a group of people or from some kind of activity the approval and comfort he cannot seem to find. Most often, and those of you who know people like me know that most often he will get into a sick sexual relationship. Or, of course, it's supposed to be spiritual. This is spiritual sex, you don't understand, you know? That's when you really watch out, when they start calling sex spiritual, because it is. Or he gets into emotional religiosity. I will not call it religion. Or he might get into gambling, or he might get into something else, but he'll always fall into some pattern of behavior which he thinks will give him that which he needs, not knowing that that which he needs must come from within himself. I call this pattern he gets into the emotional inebriety syndrome. What Bill called it was the dependency demand cycle. I depend on you for good feelings about me, and what's more, I try to control and manipulate you so I'll get the responses from you that I so deeply need. Dependency demand cycle. And it's always based on false beliefs. And it's always grounded in fear. It consists of some or all of the following. See if any of this fits you. Seeking approval and emotional security from someone or something else. Seeking reassurance constantly. Like, do you love me? Yes. Really? Yes. How much? Yeah. And you keep on and on and on. And y'all do that. I know you don't do that. You know? And it's never enough. Depending on another or others to fulfill all of your needs. Feeling like a victim and blaming others when your needs are not filled according to your expectations. Trying to possess and control another or others to ensure fulfillment of needs, and doing all these things, again, unconsciously and automatically. This pattern of behavior always leads to failure. Why? Because when the person gets what he thinks he needs, it's never enough. And so he tries harder. He pushes. And when he pushes, he drives the other people away. On the other hand, when he doesn't get what he thinks he needs, he falls into resentment or self-pity. And he tries harder. And he pushes more. And by the same token, he drives other people away from him. It's a lose-lose proposition. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, with which I hope some of you are familiar, in pages 60 to 62, it says most people like to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the scenery, the ballet, and the rest of the players in his own way. That's the story of it right there. You know who wrote that? Bill W. But he wasn't aware of what was going on in himself at that moment. Unconscious and automatic. Either way, when you get what you want, it's not enough. When you don't get what you want, you push and you lose either way. Undiscovered, this syndrome can severely damage or even destroy a person's life. Discovered, it can be dealt with in such a way that your growth will be enhanced. Are some of you, any of you out there, caught up in this syndrome? Now, if you're sure, fine. Maybe when we get to the end of this, I'll tell you some things to do about it or suggest some things. If you're not sure you're caught up in this syndrome, take a look at yourself for a few days. Get involved in some uncritical self-observation. See what you see. Watch for the syndrome or one of its manifestations. If it's there, it's there. One of the most common manifestations is usually called people-pleasing. We got any people-pleasers in here? Like all forms of the emotional inebriety syndrome, it's based on false beliefs, it's grounded in fear, and like all other forms, it always fails. Let's look at the beliefs, the dynamics, and the outcome of people-pleasing for a moment. The basic belief involved in people-pleasing is that pleasing others will beget love and approval. Not pleasing them will beget abandonment. And so the basis of the whole belief system there is the fear of abandonment. The people pleaser tries to please to get love and approval. If these are not forthcoming, he tries more. By doing this in one-to-one relationships, he places his emotions and life in the hands of the other person. He looks to the other person to fill all his needs. He puts the other person in the center of his life and makes of the other person a god. He unconsciously tries to control and possess the other to ensure fulfillment of the needs. I know that none of you have ever done that. But in many a relationship in my life, I did exactly that. I put all my eggs, if you will, in the other person's basket. And when the other person walked away, my life walked away right behind them. What is the outcome? Always. The other person abandons him. Why? His basic belief is false, and he drives the other person away by his demanding behavior. The truth of the matter is that even if you please the other to the max, it will not beget love or approval. And if you're looking to another to fill all your needs, you will, because of fear, put such pressure on the other that you'll drive him or her away. Thus, you'll bring to pass the very thing you feared, abandonment. You see, people-pleasing and all other forms of emotional inebriety are always, always self-fulfilling prophecies. Fear is predictive. As one person said in the Bible, "Lo, that which I much feared has come upon me." In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says fear is an evil and corroding thread. It sets in motion trains of circumstances which cause us to things to happen to us we felt we didn't deserve. Fear is predictive. It starts movement. It starts behavior. It controls thinking. You get involved in that fear process, and the thing that you fear will come to pass if you fear it enough. The second danger, when you become aware that you're emotionally unsober, and you can't do anything about it. The second thing is maybe more dangerous than the first. Try as he might, the person can't seem to be rid of it. He can't stop these unconscious, automatic responses to what happens to him in his life. It seems to have a life of its own, going into motion automatically. The truth is, it does have a life of its own, for it has become an integral part of his character. The only way he can be rid of it is through a profound change in himself, a change in character. Such a change can be accomplished only by the most strenuous effort And I can hear some of my alcoholic brothers and sisters saying, uh-oh, work. I've done all the work I want to do. Do I have to do this now? You know, I'm in recovery and I've been in it for a long time. Why do I have to do this? Why? And I've learned over the years there's only one answer to the question why. Because. Best answer in the world. Every child knows it. Why'd you do that? Because. Because why? I don't know. The saddest thing about this whole process, in my experience, is that most people who are emotionally unsober will remain that way at some level for the rest of their lives. Why? Some won't ever be aware of it. They'll just feel bad. Others, if aware of it, will not know what to do to change it. And others, when they know what to do to change it, will not be willing to put forth the necessary effort to do so. It's like a friend of mine told me one day, and he's been sober about a year longer than I have, and we were sitting down talking. And he said, if they'd told me when I came into recovery how many times I was going to have to surrender and how many things I was going to have to surrender to, I'd have never joined this outfit. Anybody that thinks sobriety and recovery is a free ride better think again. It's the hardest work that a human being will ever do. Recovering from a fatal illness is hard work, effortful work, purposeful work that must be done or you die. Only those who become aware they're emotionally unsober understand the nature of the problem. That's key. Have a way to deal with it and put forth maximum effort to do so, we'll be able to grow away from this thing. Grow away from it. That's the key. And even they, I have to say this, may never be totally rid of it because it's so deeply ingrained in their psyche. Right now, it's important that we not overlook something which I consider vital to this whole matter. So far, we've looked at emotional inebriety, its nature, one of its chief manifestations. And this is good as far as it goes. But we've not yet seen where it all comes from. My speculation. What are the basic causes of it? My ideas. From whence does it come? You don't have to agree with me, but I've come up with these things, and I want to share them with you. What is this something deep inside which refuses to let the person who is a good person and is doing well feel good about himself and believe he's a good person? I want to call your attention to what I am convinced is the most significant cause of this entire problem. The chief barrier to emotional sobriety, the most malignant of all defects of character. I want to call your attention, if you will, to self-hate. We don't hear much about self-hate. Well, I think we need to. Self-hate is kind of self-esteem in reverse. It is Narcissus going down to the brook and hating his reflection. It consists of a set of unconscious beliefs about self, such as, I'm no good. I'm unworthy of love. I'm a failure. I'm a loser, etc., etc., etc. What's dangerous about these beliefs is that they're negative and they're false and that they set in motion a self-fulfilling prophecy. I submit to you that if I believe I am a failure, I will be a failure no matter what. If I deeply believe I'm no good, I will prove that out in the way that I live. If I believe in my heart that I'm unworthy of your love and you try to love me, you will be hurt. How many times in the addict's life do those who are closest to us and love us the most get rolled over like a steamroller? We don't want to do that. And guess what happens? When we do that and we realize we've done that, the self-hate deepens. I really am no good. I really am a failure. I really am not worthy of that person's love. It builds on itself and builds on itself until the alcoholic or the addict who comes into recovery usually despises him or herself and is not aware of it. It bothers me, you know, to sit around meetings sometimes and I hear somebody profess how much they love themselves and how much they like themselves. Because you know what? If they have to say it that much, they've really got a problem with it. I know I used to say it. Where does self-hate come from? There are those who would say, well, it comes from addiction. I don't think so. Although it's reinforced and magnified by addiction, the beliefs which constitute self-hate do not come from addiction, in my opinion. The fact of the matter is that these beliefs precede addiction and often last well into recovery. I am aware in retrospect that I hated my guts when I was 5 years old, and I hated myself just as much when I was 5 years sober. I don't think it comes from addiction, but addiction surely breeds more and more of it. In my opinion, these beliefs are the result of the bonding of the guilt and the shame and the remorse of a person's whole lifetime. Think of it. The bonding of the guilt, shame, and remorse from your whole lifetime in one ball inside of you with a label on it. I'm no good. And they also come, I think, from significant childhood influences. I would urge our churches to be very careful about what they tell children, because children are open. They're like little blackboards you can imprint anything on. And some churches, not meaning to, talk on an adult level with these children. I don't even think you ought to talk to adults this way, but that's my opinion, okay? And here we have a situation in which religion, which should comfort and sustain us, you know, and help build our self-esteem, is constantly and forever tearing us down. When I was a little boy, I loved church. Sunday school part of it. I'd go down to Sunday school and I'd hear about this kind and gentle man who loved little children. I liked him. I like him now. Then I'd go upstairs, man. And this sweet man who I knew as the minister who visited my house and we played catch together, you know, out in the front yard. He was a nice man except on Sunday mornings. He got ugly, man. And he was sitting there and he was saying something that went like this. God hates sinners. Everybody's a sinner. Sinners are going to be put to death. And I'm sitting there, I don't know what I've done wrong for God to be mad at me. But I'm a person, therefore I'm a sinner, therefore I'm going to get killed. Now I'm dead serious about this. We need to be very, very careful about what we imprint on children's minds. One very personal opinion, and I believe if Jesus came back to earth today, he'd get out the whip again. Self-hate produces symptoms, too. Self-haters have an excessive need for acceptance or approval. Would you believe I was a straight-A student? Would you believe that in that church, the highest rank in the Royal Ambassadors for Christ in the Southern Baptist Church was Ambassador Plenipotentiary? And I made that rank faster than anyone had ever made it before. Would you believe that I was a disgustingly perfect little boy? Absolutely disgusting. Trying to get that approval, get that approval, get that approval, because I had none. And yet when I got it, I would say to myself, this is nice, but what's next? It's not enough. Desperately needed acceptance and approval. Desperately tried to get it by excelling in everything I ever did. This pattern continued all the way through college. How about y'all? 3.94 average, majored in history and philosophy, minored in religion, Greek and English, soloist with the college choir, sang in the alumni quartet, founded the college dance band, outstanding biblical student. How's that for a drunk? Who's who in American universities and colleges, 2 years running. Every honor there was, I won it, and I was drunk 75% of the time. Get out there and please them, and they'll love you. And they did, but I didn't. Self-hating people always, always sabotage themselves. I had a friend, you know, in the program, an older man. He's dead now, long dead, but I'll never forget him. He's one of my heroes. And he used to say, in my life, when things got good, that was bad. Every time things got good, I'd mess them up. Have you noticed this pattern in your clients or in yourself? When life is wonderful and there's absolutely no reason to do anything that might change that situation, you do it. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which I revere, by the way, is a story about the man who has special talents and abilities, and he uses these to build up a bright outlook for himself and his family, and then pulls the whole thing down around his head by a senseless series of sprees. There's the self-hater. Sabotaging yourself. Not doing what you know you should and doing what you know you shouldn't. Why? Self-haters treat themselves very badly. They may put up a show on the outside, but they really treat themselves really badly. I'll tell you, when I look back at how I treated me, if anybody else on the face of this earth had treated me as badly as I treated me, I would have killed them. I put myself down all the time. All the time. I remember reading a little book by Sidney Simon one time called Vultures. And vultures were what he called these put-downs that we do on ourselves all the time. And I said initially, I don't do any of that stuff. And then I started watching myself. I could have written the book and added to it. They negate compliments. Don't you just hate it? You compliment somebody and they throw it back at you. You hate that? You know? One of the first times I became aware of my own feelings about myself, I was sitting around a breakfast table with a bunch of my friends and my wife and a friend and his wife and their oldest daughter. I remember the scene just as well as if it were happening right now. And people were always telling me what a fine person I was and what a good job I was doing, and it didn't set. I didn't like it. And I'd always come back and say, well, how can you say that? Well, don't you know? And my friend finally said, look, I'm getting sick and tired of giving you compliments and having you throw them back at me. You are a fine man. You are doing a good job, and that's enough, and shut up about it. Well, you know me. I didn't shut up. I kept on. I said, if I'm such a good man, all of you take a positive inventory of me. And boy, I had them then, and I slammed out the front door. And they did. About a week later, I was handed a stack of papers about this high. He said, here's your positive inventory, done by your wife, my wife, my daughter, and me. Go read it. I said, I'll get around to it. He said, read it now. And I sat in there, and I read it, and I cried. Because they didn't say anything that was not true. I knew it. But I could not feel it. God, that's a hell of a situation. Everything they said was correct. I knew it was correct. But there was no feeling with it. I didn't believe it. I couldn't bring myself to believe it. There was a conflict inside, a wall, a barrier that was keeping me from doing these things. People who hate themselves are unable to tolerate any criticism whatsoever. You criticize a self-hater, you're putting yourself in danger. It's almost like he'll say to you, you don't dare put me down, that's my job. I'll do it, but don't you dare do it. So you got a situation where you can't compliment and you can't criticize. Anything you say is wrong. Self-haters always hurt those who love them the most for the reasons that I stated before, and then hate themselves more for doing it. They condemn themselves. Not evaluate, not judge, condemn themselves. They do little things like, I was going through the front room one night on the way to the kitchen to get a drink of water, and I'd made that trip a lot of times, and there was a coffee table in there, and I hit my little toe on the coffee table. Now that hurts. You know that? And I'm in there in the dark, jumping up and down on one leg, and I'm saying to me, I'm not even going to use the language. You sorry, no good, stupid SOB. And my toe's hurting. And finally, I came to my senses. And I said, your toe hurts. Sit down and take care of it. And I did, you know. And then I said to myself, anybody can hit their little toe on a coffee table in the dark. That doesn't make you all those rotten things you just said you were. Now go. But SOB. And my toe's hurting. And finally, I came to my senses. I said, your toe hurts. Sit down and take care of it. And I did, you know. And then I said to myself, anybody can hit their little toe on a coffee table in the dark. That doesn't make you all those rotten things you just said you were. Now go on and get your water and be very careful when you go back to the bedroom. And a self-hater, if he's going to become a non-self-hater, must learn to have this kind of conversation with himself or herself. He must learn to do it. Talk to yourself. You're the one who's condemning you. You're the one who must relieve yourself from your own self-condemnation. No one else can do it, no matter how well-meaning they may be. Throw this one in too. All self-hating people have a very negative concept of any higher power. How could they have any other concept? I'm rotten. God must believe I'm rotten too. And if I'm as rotten as I think I am, he must be a judge. Yeah, he's got his book keeping track of me. That's the height of arrogance. You know that? That God would take the time to keep a book on me. But this is a big barrier for a lot of people when they come into recovery. This higher power thing. Even though fellowships like AA make it as open as they possibly can, you know, even if you're willing to believe, they say, there's still a barrier there. What is it? The self-hate. Which throws out a certain concept of a higher power, which is frightening. The person who hates himself cannot possibly feel good about himself, nor can he believe he's a good person, period. Unless there's a radical change, he will become what he erroneously believes he is. There's that self-fulfilling prophecy all over again. How does one overcome being emotionally unsober? I believe there's a solution. But it will take a real commitment to change. It will take a means of bringing about the change. And it will take a major effort to effect that change. Why? Because we're talking about the deepest kind of change. Again, a change in character. There is no deeper change than that. Without such a change, the condition will continue. It cannot do otherwise. I was out in Kentucky not long ago, and I bought myself a t-shirt. And the caption on the t-shirt says, "If nothing changes, nothing changes." I like that. That's a truism if there ever was one, you know? And then I heard a man say, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. There must be a change in the person's deepest structure of being. Character cannot be changed by thought. Oh, I just won't do that anymore. Oh, I'll just stop this behavior right now. No, you won't. It takes more than that. There was an old timer in the program who used to just wait for me and point his finger at me and say, what I thought were silly things to me. And one of the silly things he would say to me is, boy, you can't think your way into good living. You must live your way into good thinking. And I thought that was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard in my life. But it's not. It's not. Another man said, which of you, by taking thought, can add one cubit to his stature? Character is never changed by thought. Nor can character be changed by prayer alone. Neither can affirmations or positive input from other people effectively change one's character. Why? Because the problem which we were dealing is rooted in self-hate. Note the word self. Thought and prayer alone cannot do much to alter it. There's one of my favorite stories about a rabbi and a Catholic priest, and they went to a boxing match together. And they were sitting there, and one of the fighters before the fight got down on his knees in his corner and did this. And the rabbi says to the priest, that's one of your boys, isn't it? And he said, yeah. He said, tell me, what does this mean? The priest said, don't mean a damn thing if you can't fight. The input absolutely bounce off of self-hate. Do you hear what I'm saying? Affirmations and positive input, no matter how well-meaning, just boom, 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 all over the place. They fall off. I remember once, you know, I went into therapy. That was a hoot. This was after sobriety, you know. And what it was this redhead was driving me crazy, you know. And I got, I'm not even going to get into that. It's none of your damn business, okay? This psychologist was a wonderful little guy, a little Jewish guy named Shapiro, and I loved him, and he loved me. He'd take me out for Chinese food. We got to be real good friends. He was a hypnotist, and he was real good, you know? And he'd lay me down there and get me in a trance, and he'd start talking this stuff to me about what a nice person I was, you know? And I remember one day he said to me, you're a mensch. Now, that's the Jewish word for a man in the biggest possible sense of that word. And from a deep hypnotic trance, I responded, excuse me, bullshit. I'm telling you, self-hate even goes beyond hypnotic trances. You understand what the point I'm trying to make? It bounced off. I wasn't about to believe that. I knew he meant it. I knew it was true. But I wasn't about to believe it. So there must be more. And that more
is sustained action. Notice the word sustained. Sometimes I forget, and sometimes my brothers and sisters in recovery forget, that recovery is a process, not an event. It is a way of life, if you will, to replace the way of life called addiction. It has its own value and belief system, just as addiction did. And it has to be worked on every single day, because this day is all that there is. Now is eternal. It is always now. And so we've got to do it, and we've got to do it through sustained action on proven principles. And then something will happen. One of my friends is fond of saying, if you sow a thought, you reap an act. If you sow an act, you reap a habit. If you sow a habit, you reap a character. If you sow a character, you reap your destiny. We build character by doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it until it becomes second nature to us. Characteristic of us, if you will. The change we're talking about is a change from self-hate to self-esteem. Opposite poles. It can be aided and reinforced by others, but it must be born and grow within the person himself. There is no other way. After all, self-esteem is self-esteem. Let's look at some ways and means that I've come upon. And some of you probably know how to handle this problem a lot better than I do. But the search for it and the finding of some things that are taking me out of this valley that I've been in is very important to me. And that's the reason I want to share them with you. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this tonight for the very first time is this is a part of my journey. This is a part of my process. It's important for me to share this with you. The first thing that I think any person has to do is to accept himself or herself exactly as they are right now. I don't think any change can ever occur until the struggle inside is ended and the person is, if you will, in neutral. Carl Rogers said, the curious paradox, the moment I accept myself just as I am, then I begin to change. Acceptance stops you, takes you out of gear, centers you down, makes you sit still, and you can change. Another part in the process is surrender. Surrender what? Surrender the need to control and possess. Surrender your need to demand things from other people. Stop demanding. Surrender your unhealthy dependency on other people and other groups and other institutions. Surrender the idea, please, that you can change without help. Surrender your expectations. At first, when I thought about doing this, I was going to say, surrender your unrealistic expectations. But in a real sense of the word, most expectations are unrealistic. I enjoyed an article on the airplane the other day. I was going somewhere. I'm always going somewhere. And it was by this English actor, Welsh actor, Anthony Hopkins. And I'm a great admirer of his acting ability, and I have become a great admirer of his personhood. And he said in this article three very important things. First, he said, my life is none of my business. I just go with the mystery. God or destiny or whatever just lays it out there and surprises me every now and again, and I kind of enjoy the trip. And then he said something else important, the second thing. It is not my business what other people think of me. I train myself to believe it is not my business what they think of me, and I go about my business and let the rest of the business take care of itself. And the last thing he said is I train myself every single day to have no expectations. None. Think about it. It kind of opens things up, doesn't it? And anything that happens can be a gift without those expectations. The next thing is believe. Believe that with the help of others, be they sponsors, be they friends, be they therapists, that with the help of others and with God, you can and will become emotionally sober. Beliefs, as we have seen, be they negative or positive, are very, very powerful, and they're predictive. Positive beliefs are very powerful also, and I believe they can be predictive. Next, get back to the examination of yourself. Become aware of your false beliefs about yourself, and if you can, their origins. But don't belabor yourself. Don't beat yourself up if you can't come to the reason why you did the thing at that time. Just do your best to seek within yourself. What are these beliefs in myself, and where did they come from? And more important than that, see and become familiar with the behavior patterns which are based on these false beliefs. That's even more important than knowing where they came from. Because you can react in a different way even if you don't know where they came from. Well, if you're burdening your mind with trying to figure out all the whys and wherefores, the reaction goes wanting, and the reaction is the most important thing. I believe I have to talk with another about what I find. I have to share it. I have to familiarize this other person with my behavior patterns. There are two reasons for this. First, to get it out of my system. Second, to ask this person to help me watch for these patterns. It gives me an extra set of eyes. And give him carte blanche. When you see me falling into one of these old destructive patterns, please, please tell me. Don't hesitate. Even if I get mad when you tell me, and I probably will, do it anyway. And it might be better to have two or three people doing this for you. Because, you know, my vision is limited. I need more eyes than I have. Try to repair the damage done to other people. God. When the book Alcoholics Anonymous says that the alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of other people, it tells the truth. Hearts are broken, it says. Sweet relationships are damaged. Try to repair. Try to repair. Not crawl. Please, not saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I hate that. That's a self-description. See, I was wrong. And I'm working on this. And I'm trying not to do this anymore. And I know that I hurt you. And if there's anything I can do to make that right, please tell me what it is. I will do it. That's what an amend is, not an apology. It's an attempt to repair and an openness and willingness to do what is necessary to make that repair. Ask God, whatever higher power you believe in, to help you in this process of character change. To remove these false beliefs which constitute this thing that's really eating at you. To help you forgive yourself. Any of you ever had it said to you like I had it said to me real often? I forgive you, God forgives you, why can't you forgive you? And all I could say was, I don't know. To forgive literally means to cease to resent. To give up the need for revenge or retaliation. So when I forgive myself, if I can really do it with God's help, then I'm no longer going to beat up on me. I'm no longer going to hold these strong negative feelings toward myself. And of course it's a process to come out of it, but it has to start somewhere, and I don't know about you, but I need some help. So call God into the picture if you believe in God. Even if you're willing to believe, try it. Real important. Watch for the manifestations of emotional inebriety. Watch. Watching is an ancient and honored spiritual tradition. It means wake up. Observe yourself. Look at what you're doing to yourself and others. Keep an eye on you. It means to observe me, but in an uncritical kind of a way. Uh-huh, I'm doing this. Uh-huh, I'm doing this. And make correction when I find it. And watching is very important because about all we're going to see of our self-hate and our emotional inebriety is going to be the symptoms of it, the manifestations of it. So we need to know what they are, and knowing what they are, then I need to watch for them. As I said earlier, character traits appear like taped messages. You know, a certain thing happens, I respond in a certain way. Wouldn't it be nice if we could reach inside and throw the old tape away? There goes self-hate. Wouldn't it be nice if we could put that sucker on erase and erase all that? Can't be done. How many of us have tried it? Oh, I'll forget that. Oh, I've forgotten about that incident. No, it's on the tape. The only way to change those old messages is to watch for them, and when they start to play, stop them immediately and replace them with a new message. In other words, put a new message over the old. For instance, if you tell me you love me, and I go into my typical response to that, how can you love me? 1, 2, 3. I catch myself and I stop myself and I say, excuse me, I know that you love me and I love you too. Now I put a new message on the tape. And I believe if I put enough new messages over the old message, that after a while the new message will in fact become the old message. And when that happens, when my responses are no longer what they used to be, my character has indeed changed. And that's work. And if you don't believe so, just try observing yourself for 1 hour. I invite some of you to do it. You're sitting out there saying, I don't feel that way about myself. Watch yourself for 1 hour or 2 hours or 3 hours for how many times you put you down. It might amaze you. And when you catch yourself doing it, stop. And give yourself a pat on the back. As we say over in North Carolina, cut yourself some slack. Wouldn't be bad if we'd cut other people some slack too. You know that? Give to others what you want and need. Precisely what you want and need, give it to somebody. You need some love, go love somebody. You need some kindness, go be kind to somebody. You need some compassion, be compassionate towards somebody. Do you hear what I'm saying? Give away exactly what it is that you want and need. And give without any expectation of any return. Just do it. Give, if you will, anonymously. And I'm serious about that. Try doing good things for people and not getting found out. Don't tell anybody. Just smirk. Now, that doesn't sound difficult, but it is. You know? I remember one time I did a real good thing for a college back in South Carolina. I can talk about it now, you know. And this old fella had told me, you know, about never tell anybody what you do for anybody else. And I was going to keep it a secret. And I was just giggling and everything. And somebody asked me, where'd you go? And I told them. They said, well, what'd you do? And I told them. And they said, well, what'd you do then? And they just came flying out. All the good thing that I had done just came flying out. I wanted them to know it. Why? So they'd pat me on the back. When I can give to you and not need to be found out or noticed, I made a quantum leap in recovering from emotional inebriety. As a matter of fact, I've made a quantum leap as a human being, because human beings, I believe, are here to give to one another and to keep on giving. And so the last recommendation is give to others what you want and need without expectation. Do it anonymously and keep on giving. And what you'll begin to notice is that giving in this way makes you feel good about yourself. It's funny how we miss the little things in life. When I do something nice for somebody, it makes me feel good. Now, why is it I don't go out and do more nice things? I don't know. You begin to realize that giving without expectation is its own reward. I think if you'll do all these things, and if I will do all these things and more, we will discover the great law of life. Some people call it karma, and it's secret. What we give is what we get. It is by giving to others what we want and need that we receive what we want and need. What goes around comes around. The very essence of becoming emotionally sober is the realization that this is a giving life. And through giving, we receive. How many of you were taught that? I wasn't taught that. I was taught this is a getting life.
If you want what you need, you've got to get out there, outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver everybody else on the street to get what is yours. We even have common sayings in our society. You know, the early bird gets the worm, doesn't he? The devil takes the hindmost. It's the firstest with the mostest. All of it says, get, get, get. Except spiritual programs and spiritual teachers. And every one of them, check me out, to the person has said, uh-uh. Give, give, give. What you sow, that also shall you reap. That's pretty clear, isn't it? Cast your bread upon the waters, and it will return to you. That's pretty clear, isn't it? Or, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message, to give. It is, in fact, I believe with all my heart, through giving that I shall receive. I hope this has been helpful to someone. It has helped me just to talk about it. Thanks for allowing me to be with you. And I don't know you, but I can truthfully say I love you.